Palestinian activists and groups have pledged to respond with determination to Israeli provocations as settlers prepare for a controversial march in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. China accuses NATO of creating confrontation after a vow from the Western military alliance to counter what it calls the challenges posed by Beijing. A bomb attack in a military training camp in the Somali capital Mogadishu leaves at least 15 army recruits dead. Hi everyone, welcome to World News from our Tehran studios. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Palestinian factions have warned against any Israeli aggression against their sanctities ahead of a planned march by settlers in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement in the Gaza Strip say that they will respond firmly to any provocative acts by Israeli settlers. The warning has prompted the Israeli military to raise the level of alert for air defense batteries against possible Palestinian rocket firing. Hamas has also called for protests in the Gaza Strip to counter the planned Israeli march. A similar call has been issued by the Fatah movement in the occupied West Bank. Separately, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh has sounded the alarm about dangerous repercussions of the Israeli event dubbed the March of the Flags. Again, from Ramallah, I'm joined live by Mona Kandila, correspondent. Mona, tell us about this march.
Well, let's speak first about the march. This march is usually held in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds every year. It's when the Israeli settlers celebrate what's known as the joining of the eastern and the western part of Jerusalem Al-Quds. But for Palestinians, it's the occupation of the eastern part of Jerusalem Al-Quds in 1967. Now, it was supposed to be held last month. However, due to the escalation and the tension between Hamas and Israel and firing rockets from the Gaza Strip to the Israeli occupied territories, as well as Israel's bombardment and airstrikes, after it started minutes, it was canceled. But today, the Israeli settlers have decided to proceed with Jerusalem flag march. However, up to the moment, Israel deployed 2,500 Israeli police officers and soldiers inside Jerusalem Al-Quds around the gates of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and in the old town of the city. The route is not clear up to the moment. Israeli media are saying that in the very last minute, the route of the march has been changed. But the Israeli police are saying that it's still the same. However, what's called as Damascus Gate, Bab al-Amud, it's the gate completely closed, and settlers are not allowed to enter to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. But through this gate, the Israeli military usually open it when they want to allow for numbers, dozens of Israeli settlers to raid the complex. The issue today is completely different. They say they will not open it. However, the Israeli settlers are supposed to arrive at the Damascus Gate to celebrate and to wave their flags, but not to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex or even to raid the old town of Jerusalem. Al-Quds, nothing is clear now because every hour some information are being released. However, Palestinians here in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem Al-Quds are calling for everyone who can reach Jerusalem Al-Quds to be there and to face the Israeli settlers march, not to allow them to enter to the Palestinian and Islamic section. Experts are saying this would be a new challenge for the new Israeli coalition cabinet, especially that the Israeli Prime Minister had sworn in on Sunday. On Monday, he decided that the march could take place in Jerusalem Al-Quds. The Israeli rightist settlers are saying that if Bennett changed the route or the Israeli Israeli police officers tried to prevent them from entering the old town of Jerusalem al-Quds, then he might be afraid of the threats being launched by the Hamas movement. Hamas mm-hmm. movement had warned the Israeli regime of the consequences if it allowed the Israeli settlers to proceed with the flag march and raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex or the old town of the city.
So maybe that would translate into some kind of violence. Hopefully that won't happen. Thank you very much for that. Mona Candela, correspondent in Ramallah. Yemenis have held a sit-in protest in front of the UN's office in the capital Sana'a to condemn the international community for turning a blind eye on the suffering of the impoverished nation amid the Saudi-led blockade. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more in his report.
Yemen's medical workers came together in front of the UN office to vent their anger at the continued seizure of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition, which has led to the closure of many medical facilities in the war-torn country.
The health sector has been badly affected by the siege in our country. Health facilities need fuel to be able to run medical equipment such as dialysis devices. The stopping these services means the death of thousands of patients. Today we need more medical equipment, but Saudi-led coalition prevents us from having access to them by its siege.
Yemen's Ministry of Health has announced repeatedly that most health facilities have to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel. Hundreds, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and to pressurize the Saudi-led coalition into releasing the seized oil tankers and opening Sana'a Airport.
More than 527 health facilities have been destroyed by the Saudi-led coalition airstrike so far. Meanwhile, hundreds of others have stopped providing health services due to the continued detention of oil ships en route to Yemen. This has caused an increase in the number of patients, a higher rate of death among infants and children, and spread of COVID-19 pandemic.
According to the UN, the Saudi war on Yemen, along with a years-long blockade, has driven the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
People here say tightening the blockade will only put the lives of thousands of patients at risk and hamper the political solution, as the Yemeni army says it will continue advancing to Madab city until it is fully liberated from the Saudi-backed forces.
At least five poly workers have been shot dead in eastern Afghanistan, the second such attack in the area in less than 3 months. The vaccine workers were gunned down in three separate locations across Nangarhar province. Four others were also wounded, including in the provincial capital, Jalalabad. Local police blamed Taliban militants for the coordinated attacks. The Taliban, however, have denied responsibility. A top UN official condemned the attack as inhumane. Afghan authorities say that the Taliban do not allow door-to-door vaccination campaigns in the areas they control. Afghanistan and Pakistan are the only countries where polio is still endemic. China has accused the Western military alliance NATO of artificially creating confrontations with Beijing. The Chinese mission to the European Union has urged NATO to stop exaggerating what it calls a threat theory against Beijing. The mission says that NATO's latest stance proves to be the continuation of a Cold War mentality. On Monday, NATO leaders vowed to work together to counter challenges posed by China. They accused the Asian powerhouse of threatening the international order through assertive actions, among other things. Tensions have mounted between China and the West in recent months over a range of issues, including human rights. Independent China specialist Andrew Leung says that China, as a rapidly growing economy, can overtake the United States in a matter of years.
China has been rising rapidly as an economy, and then according to various estimates, it could overtake the United States as the largest economy in the world as early as 2028. Because of this quicker recovery from the pandemic, overtaking the United States is expected to be 5 years earlier than previously expected. But there is also the concern that with China's growing influence, it could gather more friendly neighbors to undermine the dominance of the U.S. led group war order, and then eclipsing Americans' influence in the Asia-Pacific and elsewhere. So, and also the Biden administration is aware of the weakness of the previous Trump administration and try to rally support from its allies in Europe and elsewhere, the so-called G7, and also using NATO as another kind of platform to withstand the spreading Chinese influence.
A U.S. aircraft carrier group has entered the South China Sea amid heightened tensions with China. The U.S. Navy says that the strike group is on what it calls a routine mission. The Navy says the warships will be conducting maritime security operations, including flight operations and strike exercises. Washington frequently stages war games, deploying warships in the South China Sea, especially near Chinese islands. Beijing has repeatedly objected to the mission, saying that the U.S. is trying to stoke tensions at China's doorstep. At least 15 army recruits have been killed in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The victims lost their lives in a suicide bomb attack on a military training camp. Officials say that the bomber was disguised among recruits lining up outside of the camp when the explosion occurred. The attack was the deadliest to hit Mogadishu in the past 18 months. No group or individual has claimed responsibility. Similar incidents in the past have been blamed on the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. Its members have been trying to overthrow the Somali government for more than a decade. India has registered more than 60,400 new COVID cases in the past day, and that's the lowest daily rate that the country has logged since March 31st. The new figure brings the country's total caseload to 29.5 million. The South Asian nation also reported 2,700 new fatalities in the past day. The overall deaths now standing above 377,000. COVID-19 surged in India in April and May, and that caused daily infections to reach their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. India has the second largest caseload and the third highest death toll in the world. The Iranian Health Ministry has approved a domestically developed COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use. That's a feather in Tehran's cap, considering it has been under tough economic sanctions for the past few years. And it will send a signal to countries that have hoarded the vaccines and the producers that do not have a monopoly over the vaccine anymore.
Iran's health minister, Saeed Namaki, announced on Monday that the Coviran Barakat coronavirus vaccine have received approval for public inoculations.
A legal commission gave approval to the Barakat vaccine for emergency use. The Barakat complex can now distribute the vaccines it's produced. God willing, the vaccine will be added to the national vaccination program starting next week.
He said that Iran had gone through nearly a year of intensive work to join the club of countries in the world with the capacity to scale up production for coronavirus vaccines. Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and started to be mass-produced on March 29. It's been developed by Shifa Farmid, a subsidiary of the Iranian economic and industrial conglomerate Sattar. The factory says its production capacity will reach 12 to 15 million doses per month in summer. Iran is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against the coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population.
The ability of Iran to develop its own vaccine is a step forward. It would have been a lot easier, I suspect, had there been no sanctions on some of the chemicals and other things needed to develop the vaccines. So I think we have to go back to these principles. If we are serious, if the United States is serious about moving forward to prevent the spread of this virus and to save lives, then there has to be an open-handed, generous, and honest relationship with Iran, with Cuba, with China and Russia and other makers of vaccines, including India and South Africa, all of which has been impeded by this emphasis on privatization and the maintenance of sanctions.
Iran hopes that domestic initiatives could significantly boost vaccine supplies for a nationwide inoculation program that started last year.
Now, More than 4 million Iranians have received the first dose of the coronavirus vaccines as part of a national vaccination campaign that is started in February using supplies from other countries. The country of 83 million is hoping to boost the vaccination by ramping up domestic production, and the vaccines is developing in conjunction with Cuba, a country that's also under crippling U.S. sanctions.
The G7 summit in the United Kingdom ended with a pledge to distribute 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the developing world, a figure that activists say is a drop in the bucket in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. In the meantime, some Western nations have been accused of hoarding the vaccines, even though their inoculation programs have lost their momentum. Others are also accusing them of engaging in vaccine diplomacy, taking advantage of vaccine donations to seek diplomatic favors, something that even the Western countries have acknowledged.
There's no doubt there's some of this going about, and we don't support vaccine diplomacy, let alone blackmail. We think that we've got a moral duty, but also a strong vested interest in getting the world vaccinated, because we know no one's safe until we're all safe.
The major pharmaceutical companies are yet to grant a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the production of their COVID-19 vaccines, a move that would facilitate poorer nations' access to the jabs. Meanwhile, nations like Iran and Cuba have joined forces to develop their vaccines to protect their population against the coronavirus pandemic.
From my point of view, I think it's great that Iran has been able to develop a vaccine working with the Cubans and the Russians and others. And this is an important step. And I think it's one reason why the United States began to say the other day, about 3 weeks ago now, well, maybe we should relax the patents and so on and so forth. But the whole system in the last 18 months reduced the speed and the efficacy of the distribution of the vaccine.
As major vaccine producers keep away the doses from the rest of the world, vaccines built by developing countries can be a beacon of hope for millions of people.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Tech giants, including Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, have been working hand-in-hand with the Israeli regime to censor Palestinians trying to expose their regime's atrocities against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Electronic Intifada, which is published under the heading Tech Giants Help Israeli Regime Muzzle Palestinians. Stay tuned for more. Benjamin Netanyahu sought to shut down all use of the popular video sharing apps in occupied Palestine last month. The attempt to censor these apps, details of which emerged recently, is one of a number of reported attempts by the Zionist regime to control social media content during last month's military assault on the Gaza Strip. Netanyahu tried to impose the blackout as the Israeli regime faced an international social media outcry over its 11-day attack on Gaza, which killed more than 250 Palestinians, and the violent repression by the Israeli regime police of Palestinian protests in occupied East Al-Quds. Benny Gantz, the war minister, also lobbied senior officials at Facebook to crack down on posts critical of the regime of Israel, labeling some apps incitement and support for terror. The tech giants responded by agreeing to act quickly and effectively, according to a statement from Gantz's office. The revelations follow widespread reports last month that the social media corporations regularly removed posts that refer to the Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, where the Israeli regime recently stepped up moves to force out Palestinian families and replace them with Jewish settlers. Social media users and digital rights organizations also reported censorship of posts about the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. The Israeli regime's success in manipulating social media last month follows warnings from Israeli human rights groups about the longer-term threat of Israeli censorship faced by Palestinians. Adala, a legal rights group in occupied Palestine, said the shadowy Israeli cyber unit, which works hand-in-hand with the tech giants like Facebook and Twitter, had been given a blank check to police social media and muzzle online dissent. The Zionist regime's Supreme Court ruled in April that the cyber unit could continue its often secretive operations from inside the Justice Ministry, arguing that its work contributed to national security. Since 2016, the cyber unit has removed many tens and, more likely, hundreds of thousands of Palestinian social media posts in collaboration with global tech corporations. The posts are erased without any legal oversight and usually without notifying users, Adala pointed out. In many cases, users' accounts are suspended or removed entirely, or access to whole websites blocked. The vast bulk of those being silenced are Palestinians, either those under a belligerent Israeli regime occupation. Examples in the Israeli regime media, however, suggest that the regime regularly targets posts critical of Zionist regime's belligerent occupation or express solidarity with Palestinians. In court, the Zionist regime officials defended their sweeping suppression of online content by arguing that ultimately social media companies like Google and Facebook were free to decide whether to accede to its request. However, Israeli regime officials have previously boasted that the tech giants almost always agree to remove whatever content the Israeli regime demands. In 2016, the Zionist regime justice ministry reported that Facebook and Google were complying with up to 95% of Israeli requests to delete content, almost all of it Palestinian. According to reliable sources, 80% of the Israeli regime's referrals for removing content relate to Facebook and its other major platform, Instagram, both of which are heavily used by Palestinians. The next most targeted site was YouTube, where Palestinians often post videos showing attacks by Jewish settlers illegally taking over Palestinian land or Israeli troops invading Palestinian communities. The accounts of Palestinian news agencies and journalists have also been repeatedly shut down. Human Rights Watch is among those who have criticized the Zionist regime for blurring the distinction between legitimate criticism made by Palestinians and incitement. By contrast, the Palestinian digital rights group PAMLA has noted, the Israeli regime rarely takes action against Israeli Jews, even though they are responsible for posting racist material roughly every minute. And the politicized nature of the Israeli regime's crackdown on social media is often hard to disguise. In 2019, Hamla reported that fears over this online crackdown had left two-thirds of Palestinians worried about expressing their political views on social media. Other governments may look to the Israeli court's decision in April as further encouragement to adopt a more aggressive role in censoring online content. The UK, France, and the European Union already had their own cyber referral units, although unlike Israeli regimes, those units were explicitly authorized by legislation. In a sign that the Israeli regime's politicized approach to crushing online dissent could become normalized worldwide, an architect of Israeli regime's cyber unit was appointed to Facebook's new oversight board last year. Emmy Palmer was the Justice Ministry's Director General at the time the unit was established. The board is supposed to oversee what content should be allowed on Facebook and Instagram. The Zionist regime's cyber unit's increasing efforts to remove content from Palestinians are the latest stage in more than a decade of moves by the Israeli regime to control and manipulate its image online, as social media has become more central in most people's lives. The Zionist regime stepped up its digital activities after its large-scale attack on Gaza in late 2008 and early 2009, which killed large numbers of civilians, including children, and shocked much of the world. During the attack, the Israeli regime army established its own YouTube channel, the first army to do so, offering a model that the U.S. Army quickly sought to emulate. At the same time, tech-savvy youngsters were recruited to pose as ordinary web surfers as they secretly promoted foreign ministry talking points. Several cyber warrior teams established in the following years, including one that recruited former officers from the Israeli regime's military spying unit, 802. In Gaza, demonstrators have accused the Facebook and Twitter of being another face of occupation. Google and Apple have also faced a wave of criticism for colluding in the Israeli regime's policy seeking to erase Palestinians' visible presence in their homeland. The tech companies have failed to identify many Palestinian villages in the West Bank on their online maps and GPS services while highlighting illegal Jewish settlements. They have also refused to name the Palestinian territories as Palestine in accordance with Palestine's recognition by the United Nations. subordinating these areas under the title Israel.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, significance of Amr bil Ma'ruf and use of lawful means to reach a goal. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Brothers and sisters, today we are going to discuss two important lessons that as a believer we should have in our lives. The first one, as we said, is the significance of Amr bil Ma'ruf, doing or enjoining the good. See, we know that enjoining the good is something that is very natural for us. If you see someone doing something good, you feel encouraged to carry out that good task as well. You want to participate in that goodness, right? But unfortunately, the society that we live in, and because of that selfishness that over the course of time we develop in our existence, unfortunately, these two things, for the most part, they don't let us do that right thing. Islam, on the other hand, encourages the believers and appreciates the believers for stepping forward to do the good work, right? Let it be charity work, let it be helping others, let it be, you know, standing up against the oppressors, supporting the oppressed, feeding the needy, you know, so on and so forth. So, you know, Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, these lessons have been given to us practically through the lives of prophets and imams, and not just those, even other believers. If you look around, Alhamdulillah, today the Islamic world is filled with people who are ready to do good out there, who are ready to sacrifice for the cause, right? They're ready to be a voice and strengthen the voice of Amr bil Ma'ruf, which is enjoining the good. You know, those people, they are on the front line of strengthening Islam. So this should encourage all of us, inshallah, to develop this trait more and more within ourselves and, you know, get out of that whole mode of selfishness and comfort zone and, inshallah, do the right thing and strengthen Islam. Welcome back, dear listeners. Before the break, we talked about the significance of enjoining good, and we said it's such a quality that must exist in every believer. And every believer should not only do good, they should do good for the right reason, and that reason is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Enjoin good for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not to become popular, not to become this, you know, famous donor who donates so much money, or, you know, somebody who is cashing that reputation because he did something good. No, do it for the sake of Allah. This is what's important. This way you can maximize the reward you're going to get as a result of that good action. Also, use of lawful means to reach a goal is important. And let's turn to Imam Hussein alayhi salam's example. He tried to stop Umar ibn Sa'd from pursuing his evil objectives. He said to him, "You are promised the government of Ray, the modern-day Tehran, right? Yet, you will never eat the wheat of that area." Ibn Sa'd responded, "Its barley will suffice." Realizing that he couldn't change Ibn Sa'd's mind, Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, "Those who use unlawful means to achieve their objectives never attain them." So brothers and sisters, it's not the, you know, the famous thing that you have heard, ends justify the means. In Islam, ends do not justify the means. Your means have to be proper and pure and divine as well. You have to be careful. Unfortunately, we live in a pragmatic world where we somehow convince ourselves that since we have to do some greater good, this, you know, violation of Allah's law in getting to that greater good is okay. No, it's not okay. So inshallah, this is a lesson that we all need to stick to. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Justice Department will tighten its rules for when law enforcement officials may seize information about members of Congress and their aides, Attorney General Merrick Garland said on Monday, 14th of June, amid a backlash to the disclosure of a 2018 subpoena that swept in data from the Apple accounts of Democratic lawmakers and staff. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Charlie Savage. The piece is titled, Justice Department Will Toughen Rules for Seizing Lawmakers' Data, Garland says. Justice Department may tighten its rules for when law enforcement officials may seize information about members of Congress and their aides, Attorney General Merrick Garland said on Monday, 14th of June, amid a backlash to the disclosure of a 2018 subpoena that swept in data from the Apple accounts of Democratic lawmakers and their staff. Later in the day, Merrick Garland also met with leaders of the New York Times, CNN, and the Washington Post, after the disclosure of the Trump Justice Department had secretly seized phone records of reporters at each outlet in search of their sources. President Joe Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland have said that prosecutors will no longer be permitted to use that tactic. The two events underscored how recent revelations displaying the power of prosecutors to secretly seize records from phone and technology companies for leak investigations have become a major political headache for the Biden-era Justice Department, even as many questions remain about the context. David McGraw, a New York Times newsroom lawyer who attended the meeting with his publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, portrayed the discussion about restricting the ability of leak hunters to go after reporters' data as positive. Under an agreement, news executives were permitted to disclose what they said, but Attorney General Merrick Garland's responses were off the record. In today's meeting, we once again sought a full accounting of what happened and requested that the Department of Justice codify that it will no longer seize journalists' records during leak investigations, Mr. Sulzberger said in a statement. We were encouraged by Attorney General Merrick Garland's statements, but we will continue to push until our concerns are addressed. The meeting came hours after Attorney General Merrick Garland had addressed the political uproar over the subpoena for congressional information, which the New York Times reported last week. He said he had asked his deputy, Lisa O'Monaco, to review and toughen the department's existing policies for obtaining records of the legislative branch, noting that she was already working on surfacing potentially problematic matters deserving high-level review. Mr. Garland added, consistent with our commitment to the rule of law, we must ensure that full weight is accorded to separation of powers concerns moving forward. That announcement came as John C. Demers, the Trump administration official who leads the Justice Department's National Security Division, which oversees leak investigations, told his staff that he would step down at the end of next week. On Sunday, Democratic lawmakers had called for John C. Demers to testify about a subpoena that swept in congressional information, along with the former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and the former Attorney Generals Jeff Sessions and William Barr. But on Monday, 14th of June, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader in the Senate, denounced those calls, saying that an investigation by the Justice Department's independent inspector general was sufficient. By calling for a congressional inquiry, he said, top Democrats gave in to the urge to pick at the scab of politically motivated investigations. The Department of Justice is empowered to investigate criminal conduct by members of Congress and their staff. Necessarily, this sort of investigation is subject to strict procedural protections, Mitch McConnell said. The department's inspector general is fully equipped to determine whether these procedures were followed. I'm confident that the existing inquiry will uncover the truth. He also said that it was particularly disappointing that our colleagues are attacking Bill Barr over investigative decisions that occurred when he wasn't there yet. The grand jury subpoena that swept up congressional information was dated February 2018, when Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein were still the top two officials in the Justice Department. Still, after William Barr was sworn in the following year, the New York Times has reported, he brought in a trusted prosecutor with little relevant experience to help reinvigorate several leaked cases, including that involved congressional Democrats and their staff. Eventually, it was shut down without charges. Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois, the number two Democrat who has supported calling for former Attorney General to testify, pushed back at Mitch McConnell's suggestion that there was nothing amiss, asking, how would he know that? Senator Richard Durbin, who is also the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, sent a letter signed by the other 10 Democrats on that panel to Merrick Garland on Monday, asking for a copy of the subpoena and internal emails and other records related to it, and posing questions about its basis and purpose. Subpoena appears to have been part of a leak investigation that centered on a Democratic aide on the House Intelligence Committee. The New York Times has previously reported that it's listed 109 phone numbers and email addresses and sought account data linked to those numbers. Two lawmakers, Representatives Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, both Democrats of California, were among those whose account information Apple turned over, along with aides and a relative of Adam Schiff's. The broad subpoena appears to have been an example of a common technique investigators use when they obtain the communications records of a target. By subpoenaing electronic communication providers for any account information linked to those phone numbers or email addresses, they can identify the people with whom the target interacted. For example, many people own a smartphone that uses either Apple or Google's operating systems and register their phone numbers with one of those companies when setting up their devices. Those accounts may also have their names, addresses, email addresses, data about the phone and computer hardware they use to access the account, and sometimes even credit card numbers. While the controversies over secret Trump-era seizures of data about reporters and about lawmakers and their staff have partly emerged, there is an important difference. The phone data seized about reporters at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN centered on a type of metadata, calling logs, that reveals whom people have spoken with. The Justice Department also carried out a related legal fight over a court order it obtained for logs of the reporters' emails, which can also reveal social contacts that spilled into the Biden era and included gag orders imposed on executives at the New York Times and CNN. By contrast, there is no sign that the subpoena to Apple could have provided investigators with a type of metadata that would offer a systematic look at the lawmakers' contacts with other people. According to law enforcement officials, prosecutors cannot use a grand jury subpoena to obtain email logs. Instead, they obtain court orders if they want to seize the information logging senders and recipients of emails and other types of electronic messages. Apple, which is not a phone company and does not generate traditional calling logs, has said it turned over only account subscriber information in response to the grand jury and that it did not provide any content such as emails or pictures.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM. 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio. Herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In continuing our discussion on the beautiful saying of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, commonly known as the hadith of Junudul Aql wa Jahl, or the hadith that describes, rather the Imam doesn't describe, the Imam merely in a general form, mentions the units or the battalions that are under the army of the intellect or aql and that of jahl. So here we see that the Imam again mentions two characteristics, one for the aql, one for the jahl. And the one for the aql the Imam mentions in this particular tradition is known as al-ma'rifah. And that which the Imam mentions in terms of jahl, or rather the unit that is within jahl, is al-inkar. So what is ma'rifah? Ma'rifah has many different meanings in the Islamic sciences, depending which of the Islamic sciences that you intend to go with. But the general meaning of ma'rifah is to know something, is to recognize something, is the ability to see that this is the truth. Another place of ma'rifah could be a deep understanding of something. But because the word that has been given as the antonym of this is al-inkar, which means to deny something. Now this denial is not just a basic denial. It is a denial when you do inkar of something, when you deny something in this way, it is that a person recognizes or he understands that that which is in front of him is correct. This is one of the meanings of inkar. So this tradition is that a person not only recognizes the truth in front of him, but he also accepts it and decides to follow it. Obviously, this is what an intellectual person will do, is that he is aware of the truth in front of him. He knows that that which is in front of him, and he recognizes it as being haq, as being truth, and therefore takes it, follows it, protects it, and so on and so forth. Whereas on the other side, if a person does inkar, he denies it. It is not denied because he has any proof. He denies it just because of many of the other characteristics that he may have, one being pride, one being laziness, another one, for example, being, for example, not having the ability to understand or not making the efforts to understand. Or he may have made the efforts and just because he just doesn't want to. You know, that concept of, you know, boastfulness and arrogance within him does not allow him to do so. So we see that this is what is possibly or can possibly be meant by this saying of the Imam, where he mentions the word al-ma'rifah and al-inkar as antonyms of one another in this particular way. One is knowing and following, the other one is, you know, not having the ability to deny, but denying anyway. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to increase us in ma'rifah and to decrease us and actually not have any inkar within us. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
The debate.